Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 12. In keeping with her goal of putting some order into her life, Callie christened another of the unnamed kittens Freya, after the Norse goddess of love and beauty. The name popped into her head as she cleaned out the cat room one day, along with the crazy idea of taking the name herself. This didn't occur to her because she saw herself as a goddess of love and beauty, she with the worn L.L. Bean boots and front loader filled with cat waste. Freya appealed to her because of the goddess's mode of transportation, a chariot pulled by cats, and one of her favorite activities, scooping up young men and carrying them off to her cat house for a little rest and recreation, something Callie thought she could use herself, with or without the sex. Sensing a similarity between this vision and Bernice dancing barefoot through the house as Venus, "Oh my God, did Freya wear a brass bra?" Callie snatched up a kitten and christened her Freya. Then she finished her chores, content in the knowledge that she had imposed yet more order on her life. After Nana died, Callie took Billy to work with her every day that someone else didn't have something planned for him. As she had feared, once he lost Nana, his own health began to deteriorate more rapidly, but he understood his own condition well enough that he refused to get another pet. Although she didn't agree with that decision, Billy had his pride, and once he made up his mind about something he considered in his province, no one could make him change it. He could still get around all right, but Penn, Joe, Callie, and other Addison residents quickly organized themselves to respond to any and all changes in his condition at a moment's notice. At the granary, Billy sorted seed packets, helped Penn arrange displays, and did other chores that didn't tax his strength but nonetheless made him feel useful. About the same time, another change occurred that caused Callie to consider her future yet again. From the first day she worked at the granary, the local residents had brought in their pets for her to see. Some of them wanted veterinary information, but most were just proud folks who wanted her to meet their non-human family members. At first, Penn didn't mind because he liked animals, and their presence added a certain cozy ambiance to the place. Even though he'd never admit it, he knew very well that he owed much of the granary's success to the tourists who found it quaint. Add a few furries to quaint, and even a business school dropout could smell the profit potential. Over time, though, the pets became more exotic, and more of their owners came seeking advice for specific ailments. "You know, Callie," Penn casually broached the subject after they spent 3 hours trying to get a screeching African gray parrot with screaming diarrhea down from the rafters, "I'd be more than happy to let you set up a practice in the lean-to." Although the word lean-to typically elicits images of ramshackle additions, when Penn took the granary upscale, its lean-to went with it. It would make an ideal location for a practice if Callie could make up her mind that this was what she wanted to do. Meanwhile, the animal visitations continued and escalated even more when the townspeople realized how much Billy enjoyed them, too. But all good things must end. It began when Addison's acclaimed junior herpetologist showed up with his 6-foot boa one morning. Billy and Callie took turns draping the snake around their necks, although she doubted Billy imagined himself lying naked with the snake, posing for a famous photographer like she did. Then a typical day's complement of local dogs and cats arrived. However, instead of helping their animals pick their own food and treat like some tourist, the solid folks of Addison let their pets wander while they attended to these duties themselves. Unfortunately, a rather ill-mannered but universally friendly Rottweiler took an exaggerated interest in the boa and leaped upon the junior herpetologist to get to know the reptile better. Callie knew that the dog meant the snake no harm, but none of those present had time to tell the snake that before she rapidly slithered off her owner and disappeared into a stack of dog food with a Rottweiler right behind her. No sooner had the Rottweiler's owner dragged him out in disgrace than a tourist bus crammed with senior citizens taking in the fall foliage arrived. Normally, Penn viewed tourist buses as manna from heaven, but not when a 6-foot snake slithered through his inventory doing God knows what, God knows where. "Get that friggin' snake out of here," he hissed at Callie and the junior herpetologist who looked at her helplessly. Callie, the boy, and a few helpful locals quickly took up strategic positions, keeping their eyes peeled for suspicious linear movement with the idea of at least scaring the snake back into hiding until the bus left, if they couldn't catch her in some discreet way. As the tourists entered, remarks such as, "Oh, isn't this too perfect?" filled the air, and for a few brief moments, Callie thought they might succeed in pulling off the great boa caper. Suddenly, a familiar voice bellowed, "Shut the damn door!" a statement that caused many of the elderly patrons to gasp. Those who didn't gasp certainly did when a four-legged black thing came flying into the granary, leaving a bloody paw print every time he put his foot down, which he did often, on the floor, the displays, and the clothing of anyone not fast enough to get out of his way when he gleefully jumped on them to greet them. As if this weren't bizarre enough, Joe McDermott shot through the door behind the dog and leaped over displays of chrysanthemums, baskets of bulbs, and bags of potting soil in an attempt to head the creature off. Joe and the dog, by then Callie had decided it had to be a dog because she couldn't imagine what else it could be, ran around and around the granary with the dog bleeding from his obviously cut foot pad and Joe cursing him the whole time. Eventually, though, the dog paused in front of a stack of pet food to catch his breath. Quite naturally, all eyes turned toward him and thus noticed when the curious boa decided to slither out of the stack behind him and take a look herself. "A snake!" screamed an upscale patron, who then sank slowly to the floor. "Oh, my God!" screamed her companion. "Stella has swooned!" Rather than this remark precipitating a flurry of assistance for Stella, it brought everything to a screeching halt. In the brief instant it took the others to ponder when, if ever, they had actually heard someone use the word swoon, the junior herpetologist wrapped his snake around him and fled, and Joe leaped on the dog, who licked his face in delight. "Lean to, lean to," Penn shouted. "Get that friggin' dog into the lean to," while Billy clapped his hands and beamed. Callie snatched up a gardening towel with "I Love New Hampshire" embroidered on it and tossed it to Joe. "Keep some pressure on that foot while I make sure Stella's all right," she ordered him, fighting desperately not to laugh. Joe and the dog disappeared with Billy at their heels while she turned her attention to the prostrate senior citizen. By then, Stella had recovered, thanks to her companion's smelling salts. Perhaps all the Victoriana got to Penn, or maybe he just saw visions of lawsuits. Whatever the reason, he dropped to his knees before Stella and presented her with a huge potted mum, a gallon of maple syrup, and his most heartfelt apologies delivered in a Yankee drawl Callie had never heard him use before. Stella appeared so touched by all this, Callie feared she'd swoon again. Penn then invited all the tourists to trade their bloody garments for upscale Addison Granary sweatshirts or sweatpants, while helpful locals removed the bloodstains from their clothing. While he did that, Callie got her medical kit out of the van and retreated to the lean-to. "What the heck is that?" she asked Joe. "It's a dog," he said, trying to keep the lanky beast still while she examined the cut on his foot pad. "I sort of gathered that much, but what kind of a dog?" She continued interrogating him as she anesthetized the animal with an ultra-fast anesthetic. "You're the vet. I thought you'd tell me." She could see his point, but this particular canine looked unlike any she had ever seen before, at least outside of cartoons. His long-legged, skinny body and long floppy ears sported a random curly coat, as if it rolled in the leftovers after someone finished making a real dog. "He looks like the result of a drunken orgy between a greyhound and a poodle," she finally volunteered her professional opinion as she tied her last suture and began to bandage the dog's foot. "He goes well with your image." "My image?" Joe appeared surprised by the comment. "I got him for you," a remark that surprised her. "For me? When did you ever hear me say I wanted a dog?" "Never, but you're a vet." "What kind of a vet doesn't have any pet? Besides..." His words trailed off and his eyes shifted from her to Billy stroking the awakening dog. "Joe, I don't want or need a dog right now," she protested, but not in a way that communicated any distress that Billy might detect. "You need a dog to take to the woods with you much more, to keep you safe." Joe glared at her, then allowed his eyes to drift back to Billy again. She got the message, but she did not need a dog, and especially not a big, young, untrained pup. Billy twirled the dog's curls around his fingers again and again, while Joe looked at her without saying a word. "Okay," she semi-relented, "I'll make you a deal. I'll keep the dog with Billy during the day and then drop the two of them off each evening. If Billy wants to keep him overnight, fine. If not, you can take him then." Callie didn't think she offered Joe exactly the plan he had in mind, but she allowed her eyes to drift to Billy stroking the dog, and there really wasn't much he could do. By then, the pup had almost completely recovered from the anesthetic and happily nuzzled Billy's hands. Joe nodded his head in agreement somewhat reluctantly, and she relayed the news to Billy, who beamed at Joe. "What did you tell him?" Joe asked suspiciously. "That this was your dog, and Billy and I were going to teach him some manners and take care of him for you sometimes." Joe carried the pup back into the granary proper and held him while Callie fitted him with a collar and leash. Then he put the dog down after she handed the end of the leash to Billy, who signaled to her excitedly. "Billy wants to know what you named your new dog," she added, scanning the now quite happy tourists who smiled benevolently at them. Callie thought Joe wanted to say something totally unrelated and most likely profane, but the sight of Billy stroking the pup's head caused him to change his mind. "Tell him his name is Curly," he replied curtly. Callie relayed the message to Billy, who curled the curls of the pup's forelock around his fingers again and showed he understood. Then she turned to Joe, patted him on the arm, and said, "You're a nice person." Yet another pattern slowly began to take shape that fall. While Callie worked in the granary, Billy trained Curly, his patience and consistency the envy of every unruly dog owner in the county. Before long, the young dog would come, sit, stay, and lie down when signaled. Callie also taught him voice commands for the benefit of those humans who didn't understand hand signals. Billy resisted keeping Curly the first few nights, but eventually the pup so won him over he capitulated. This pleased her greatly because housing Curly evidently cut into Joe's social life, and he had called to complain no less than 3 times each night he kept the dog. "Your damn dog chewed my wallet," he shouted as he charged into the granary the morning following Curly's most recent sleepover with him. "I thought you said you trained him." "He's not my damn dog, he's your damn dog," she reminded him. "How did he get your wallet?" "It was on the floor." "Far be it from me to criticize your personal habits, Joe, but what was your wallet doing on the floor?" While he granted, Joe let the pup wander around the store where he naturally zeroed in on the bins of treats. Billy signaled, and Curly came to him immediately and lay at his feet. Callie turned back to Joe, who obviously had no intention of answering her question. "Rule 1 in dog training is that you must always be smarter than the dog, Joe," she said, smiling at Billy. "I think that's your problem." From then on, Curly spent his nights with Billy. During the afternoon, Billy, Curly, and Callie would run errands, visit, or just hang out at the farm with the cats. It didn't surprise her that Curly loved cats because he loved everyone and everything. However, initially the cats didn't share this view, and their first encounter proved rather harrowing for both her and them. Rather than letting the cats into the house with its numerous nooks for them to hide in while they studied the rambunctious pup at their leisure, Billy took Curly into the cat room and turned him loose. Big mistake. Hissing cats launched themselves like furry missiles with claws at anyone or anything in their paths. So upset were they, Callie felt obligated to let all the cats sleep with her that night, even under the blankets if they wished, a special treat usually reserved for the sick and injured. "Just to show you how much I really do love you, I'm going to read you David's latest email," she announced, a statement that did little to erase the suspicious looks that practically all of the cats had worn since Curly's visit. "My darling Callie," David wrote. "Oh, Lord, not again," she groaned to the cats. "I bet you're wondering why you haven't received a wedding invitation yet, like everyone else," he continued. Actually, the thought had never crossed her mind, because she didn't want to receive an invitation until she had located a suitably nice gift. On the other hand, she didn't want not to receive an invitation if that meant the wedding was off. If that happened, David could decide he loved her again, another issue she couldn't possibly deal with since she had yet to resolve why she had fled from him in the first place. But then she read on and discovered that the real reason why she hadn't received an invitation was even worse. "Marilyn and I want you to be part of the wedding party," David wrote with a flourish. "Blech," she told the cats, thinking of her low self-esteem and limited wardrobe again. Callie almost gave in to the temptation to put the letter aside for another day rather than read the details of Marilyn's idea of bridesmaids' gowns. Although she had only met the woman once, she sensed deep within that Marilyn liked ruffles, a clothing appendage Callie detested because they made her feel like a fringed lizard. However, curiosity compelled her to continue reading. "We want you to drive the nuptial carriage," proclaimed the email with an excess of exclamation points Callie found disturbingly reminiscent of Bernice. "He wants me to drive the nuptial carriage," she repeated to the cats, fighting desperately not to explode into the kind of hysterical laughter that more commonly signals a breakdown rather than a breakthrough. "Dear God, how does he come up with these ideas?" "Knowing how you completely immerse yourself in your work, I can't imagine you not becoming a skilled teamster to complement your new practice." David's explanation made it perfectly clear that Callie's own insanity served as the source of his idiotic suggestion. "Marilyn would really like a four-horse team, but I don't want you to agree to something that requires more expertise than you have." "Good thought, David," she congratulated him as visions of her ruffled self at the helm of the nuptial carriage careening through the wedding guests filled her mind. It took her two attempts to get a license to drive a car. She wiped out four bushes and hit her own vehicle while learning how to operate her front loader. She had ridden the horse twice and barely stayed on both times. Plus, she suffered from low self-esteem, a questionable genetic heritage, and God only knew what neurochemical imbalances in her brain. Taken all together, she could no sooner drive a team of horses than levitate cats. After he had proffered his most exciting news, David went on for several paragraphs describing the age, sex, and color of the horses under consideration, the harnesses and other paraphernalia that came with them, the state of their feet — Jingles had a slight problem with laminitis, but is fine now — their diet, and a lot of other details that surely would have interested an equine practitioner had Callie been such a person. Because she wasn't, this material caused her to giggle in a manner she found worrisome. "I have to write him the truth," she told the cats after she concluded this latest epistle. Believing this the only decent and caring thing to do, and fortified with several glasses of wine, she made several unsuccessful attempts, the last of which read, "Dear David, thank you so much for inviting me to drive the carriage at your wedding. I have lied to you, David. I cannot accept such an honor because I do not know how to drive a team. I do not know this because I have no equine practice. I have no practice at all. I am a clerk in a feed store and collect cats from dumpsters and under toilets. I am a sick person. I am so glad you found someone nice like Marilyn to spend your life with. It is better this way. Your friend always, Callie." When she awoke sober and reread the message the next morning, she deleted it. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.